do have a quorum.
Good afternoon. The February 4th, 2009 meeting of the Senate's Public Safety Budget Division will come to order. We have budget presentations today from the two big departments in our division, Department of Corrections and the Department of Public Safety. And I believe there is information on the cart for people in the audience who would like to look at the various handouts that will be available today. We're planning to do about an hour for each department. And then if we identify things that need further discussion and we run out of time today, we'll schedule them for someday next week. At least that's what we're thinking right now. Let's start with the Department of Corrections. Commissioner Joan Fabian, Deputy Commissioner Lynn Dingle, and Lisa Cornelius, Assistant Commissioner for Support Services. Welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
We're going to engrave you guys' names on the backs of those chairs by the time we're done this session, I'm afraid.
Oh, no.
Go ahead and start whenever you're ready.
Madam Chair, committee members, I want to thank you for the opportunity to present our budget. As you're well aware, one of state government's most fundamental responsibilities is to keep its citizens safe. And the Department of Corrections really exists to carry out that mandate. We're responsible for locking up over 9,700 of the state's most dangerous and violent offenders, as well as providing opportunities for them to change, and supervising and holding offenders accountable in our community. Minnesota is consistently recognized as one of the best and most effective corrections systems in the nation. We have one of the lowest recidivism rates, and also we cost less than corrections departments in 48 other states. I'll just start the presentation, and hopefully someone has handed out that blue report. The page. Okay. If you look on that, that's a Pew report that was done in 2008. Basically, on the first page of it, there's a red line at the bottom of the first page. And what it does is show you the rate, how much is spent out of the general fund by state, the percentage. And in Minnesota, we spend 2.7% of the general fund compared to a national average of 6.8%. And on the other side is a comparison of how many dollars are spent on corrections compared to how many are spent on higher education. And if you look, the highest one is Oregon, with for every dollar spent on higher education, they spend over $1.30 on corrections. Minnesota spends 17 cents. We're the lowest. So I'm making the point, obviously, that I think you're getting a really good deal for what we provide. The second slide basically just gives you a little overview that we are ranked the 31st lowest in terms of our crime rate, our recidivism. 36% of released offenders recidivate within 3 years of release, compared to between 50 and 75% in some other states. And part of what makes us different as well is we reserve prison beds for the most serious offenders, and have greater use of partnerships at the local level. The next slide, I think, is also showing how different we are. What we did was look at states that were similar in population to Minnesota. Indiana with 6.3 million, all the way down to Kentucky with 4.2. We, again, as I mentioned, are 49th lowest in terms of our prison population. You look at Louisiana there with over a million fewer population, state population. They have 37,000 people locked up in prison versus our over 9,000. And every other state listed on there, you see the high number of people that are incarcerated. Again, this is why we are so different, is that we don't lock up low-risk offenders.
Commissioner, is there a chart that's available that would show people in the various community corrections programs in these states? Because I know we do a really good job of keeping people in the community, but I'd be curious to know if any of these other states are doing anything.
Madam Chair, I haven't seen one like that, but we are, looking. There aren't a whole lot of states that are in community corrections. Of course, since this budget crisis has hit most of the states, we get calls, every day trying to figure out how they can get their state to go into community corrections.
Okay, great. Thank you.
If you look at the next slide, the comparison to Wisconsin, again, we have similar state populations, but the prison inmates in Wisconsin, there's 22,000 in Wisconsin's prison compared to, around 9,200 in ours. And again, why we're so different is that many years ago we looked at the fact that, the most serious people should come to prison, and that philosophically we believe that people are better off sanctioned at the local level. Their budget is $1.2 billion per year versus ours at, $472 million. 36 prisons that they operate compared to our 8. The next slide just shows how we have increased in spite of, trying to keep and doing all kinds of things. Sentencing guidelines is one of the reasons why we have a low prison population as well. And you do see, an increase. It has slowed down back between 2004 and 2005 and 2006. Drug offenders really did push the prison populations up, and that was when we had the meth epidemic. But that has certainly at this point receded some, and so our growth has slowed. Also, despite what some people have been testifying in other committees, we're not planning to build a jail or a prison every 4 years. We have a long-range plan. We think with the plan that we have that we will not have to build for, till at least 2017, if even then.
Senator Moore.
Madam Chair and Commissioner, I'm so sorry. I have a question that's lingering from the previous chart, the comparison to Wisconsin chart, and I wanted to focus on the rest of the presentation instead of just thinking about this. I wonder if you could go back and answer that for me.
Sure.
When we're looking at the comparison of the number of prison inmates, the 22,000 versus 9,000, and then we look at the adult probation, parole and release, and then we look at the total budget, that 1.2 budget is for Wisconsin, the 22 plus the 71,000, yes? Is that...
Madam Chair, Senator Moore.
Commissioner?
Yes.
Okay. And then for Minnesota, the $472 million is also for the is the budget for the $9 million plus the $132?
Madam Chair, Senator, this is only money that the state provides. So what I compared to show the difference is that, instead of bringing people to prison, they put them, we have them in the community and they're locally sanctioned. Of that money, of our total budget, about $70 million goes through to community corrections and the CPO counties.
So just to make sure that I'm not that I'm tracking, if we were to so run that by me again, I'm sorry. The prison inmates, the 9,000, the 9 million, right?
9,000.
The 9,000 for the prison inmates. That's 100% on the state budget. And then of the 132,000, a portion of that is on the state budget and a portion of that is on the county budget.
Yes.
So, Madam Chair and Commissioner, the $472 million speaks only to the state portion for the $9 million plus the $132 million.
Chair, Senator Moore, yes.
Madam Chair and Commissioner, if we were going to account for, if we're going to look at the total number, and we're going to account for the total, understanding the split between the state and the county, but if we want a realistic vision or a realistic number of what the total would be, what would that be if we were to take into account the portion that the counties are taking up for the community corrections piece?
Madam Chair, Senator Moi, I'm not sure. I know it would be, at least $300 million.
Okay.
So,
but we're talking about how much the state pays.
So just to be sure, so if we were going to do apples and oranges, we would add approximately $300 million to the $472 million if it was to be comparable to Wisconsin's number?
Madam Chair, yes.
Okay. Senator Moy, any more?
That's what I wanted, Madam Chair.
Okay, Commissioner, go ahead, please.
And of course, my point I'm trying to get across here is how much of the state budget is going in. Okay. One of the things I had met with Senator or Madam Chair about was just the inmates that are coming to prison. And the next few slides give you some detail about who's coming to prison.
Commissioner, can I stop you there for a sec? Back on that same page, the bottom bullet says it does not include the juvenile probation folks. Does the $472 million number include funding for the juvenile facility at Red Wing?
Madam Chair... Yes, it does. We split it because we were trying to compare in Wisconsin how many were under supervision, just to make the point that, we use local sanctions much more than sending them to prison. So we only compared adults. And as you see down at the bottom, we have an additional 14,000 juveniles that are under supervision as well.
Thanks. I'll try not to interrupt again for a while.
Yep. Anytime you want to interrupt is just fine, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you. I'm a slow learner today, I guess.
I just want to, emphasize the fact that offenders coming to prison in Minnesota are not low-risk offenders. The inmate profile that you see there, 50% of the offenders coming to prison are person offenders, and about 17% of that 50% are sex offenders, or almost 18%. In many, many other states, property offenders make up the majority. We only have serious property offenders, and I'll get into that as we go through this. The other ones, of course, since 2002 is the addition of DWI, and that certainly has grown as well. And the next few slides get into each category in more detail. The person offense, what we have here is the there's 2,953 people that are in prison on their governing offense is a person offense. And that includes murder, aggravated assault. The average number of prior convictions for inmates coming to prison is 5.8%. And if you look at the percentages of those offenders that their person offense, 51% of their prior offenses coming to prison are person offense. 8% of their priors are sex offenses. They had 51% property offenses, and you can see the rest of it there. drugs, again, you keep hearing how there's so many low-level, non-dangerous drug offenders in prison. That just is not the case. And the ones coming in, 20% our inmate population right now, their governing offense that they came in on is a drug offense, and most of that is meth or crack cocaine. 70% of offenders are incarcerated for first and second degree drug offenses. A number of plea bargains happen, and they're reduced from first and second degree down. The average number of prior convictions is 7.3 prior convictions before they come to prison on drug cases. And again, you can see 44% of those priors were person offenders. They had 58% were other drug offenses that they were convicted of before they came. The sex offense category, which is 17.6% of our population, 89% victimized someone that they knew, family members 33%, acquaintances or other known 56%, and 11 strangers. They had 4.1 prior convictions before they came in. Property offenses, again, this is one that people think is not serious, and, you know, one maybe isn't, but they have 11.5 prior convictions before they come to prison, which I think is pretty significant. And you look, 52% of those were prior person offenses, 83% prior property offenses, 42% drugs. So and we also have offenders that are coming in on a governing offense of property, say a burglary, but the real offense was a rape, and it was plea bargained down. So you can't tell by looking at property that that was the that they're just a property offender. I think everybody's interested in DWIs now. What we looked at was all of them. Right now we have 663 offenders in prison for DWIs. They had an average number of prior convictions, 11.8 prior convictions before they come to prison. Obviously, 100% of them had to have prior DWIs to have it be a felony. But 57% of their priors were person offenders. 7% weapons, 61% property. Of these DWI offenders, there were only 23 of the 663 that were whose prior convictions were DWI only.
Commissioner, I think that's way different from an email I got from your department here a couple of days ago. That I believe it was, let me see if I can find it here. Of the 663, 62% have only the current active DWI sentence. So that to me means that they have only DWI, assumably the three or however many that put them there.
And I'm not sure. What we're saying here is that only 23 had their only prior convictions were DWI. Of an active sentence, these are priors, so they wouldn't be in. I guess it's how you ask the question.
I suppose.
Okay. I'll be glad to get that clarified.
Madam Chair, perhaps it might be helpful to have what the numbers of them that are actually in there for DWI and then for DWI plus something else, so we would know the source of that.
Commissioner, did you hear Senator Foley?
I'm sorry, I didn't.
He's asking for information on how many are there strictly for DWI as opposed to DWI plus other crimes. So it's 663 who are there whose governing offense is a felony DWI.
think that's what your slide shows.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry that you wanted to know. I'm sorry, Senator.
Senator Foley, would you repeat your question?
Well, I'm curious to know.
Speak into the microphone, please.
How many just plain vanilla DWI versus the others that have another conviction or multiple convictions?
Madam Chair, Senator Foley, I believe that's 23. The only reason 23 had no other priors. 23 of the 663 had no other priors except DWIs.
Okay.
Does that answer your question?
I'm not certain, Madam Chair, Commissioner, as to where this percentage is that you just indicated that you...
I don't think it's on the chart, Senator Foley.
I have it on my own personal notes.
Yeah. So will we figure out at some point how we can reconcile the difference between the 411 number that I got the other day that said have only the current active DWI sentence?
Madam Chair, I'll be glad to do that.
23 number.
I had talked to Grant Dewey, who is our research person, just before I came, and he gave me this. But okay. I'll definitely check on it. And, you know, I won't go by detail. The next two, in weapons, the governing is a in weapons, that's the governing offense. They had 7.3 prior convictions, and the last one in the other category had 9.1, an average of 9.1 prior convictions. I know that... the state is in a major crisis with the state budget and that difficult decisions have to be made. But the reality is that we really have cut every non-core position that we can cut. And I truly believe that further reductions are going to compromise public safety. In spite of what others are saying, DOC has made major cuts in the last 6 years, over $85 million in operational changes. We've, cut over 300 staff, or approximately 300 staff. And in addition, we're trying to absorb a $10 million deficit at this point. We spent many hours trying to come up with a responsible way to cut 5% like other departments, which would have been a $46 million cut to corrections. And every alternative that we considered, we felt endangered either public safety or staff safety in our prisons or state and county agents on the street. The governor was very clear that public safety is one of his major priorities and that he is unwilling to compromise staff safety or public safety. You know, we've talked before that, we are unique as an agency, and our population is totally driven by the courts. We have no control over our intake. And we can't have waiting lists or reduce hours or, close a prison. We have no other funding. Our main funding is from the general fund. We don't have other alternative fundings like some other department does. And I guess the important thing that I want to stress is, every day you read about the predators and the violent offenses that happen on the streets. And when a prison sentence, when a prison sentence is imposed, it might be a change in what's happening on the streets, but they all come to prison, and we deal with them, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Unlike most agencies that we have to be staffed 24/7, intensive community service agents are out there, holidays, nights, weekends. Our agency, and I think the the consequences for budget reductions in our agency are different than in other agencies. In most other agencies, a lack of adequate personnel and resources is not going to result in somebody getting stabbed in the back or beaten up, or when they make an unannounced visit in the field that they can shut. I think it's important that you in corrections at both the state and level that you understand that real people are working in these positions and that it's really dangerous. I don't know of any staff that has been in our profession for very long that hasn't been threatened, that hasn't been put in dangerous situations. What we'd like to do is just give you just a real short clip, about 4 minutes, that just gives you some of the realities of what our staff are faced with every single day.
Senator Ingberson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Commissioner, for the report. What's not included, I might ask here, is on the one that you have up there right now is the private prison in Appleton. And how many prisoners do we have in Appleton, and what is that costing per year right now? Maybe that's someplace in your report here.
It's in her head. Madam Chair, Senator, we have 480, about 480 inmates at Appleton right now, and it costs us about $20 million this year for beds. We had up to 1,200 there, and because of our budget, the $10 million deficit, we've been trying to bring them back more quickly and put them at Faribault, the expansion at Faribault, which will be approximately $55 a day as opposed to, I think it's about 60.
So, Madam, just to follow, so
Senator Ingberg,
the total you're talking about here includes those in Appleton. That's correct?
Madam Chair, Senator, yes, it does.
Okay, and does that include the short-term offenders that are out in the counties?
No, it doesn't.
Okay, maybe you're going to report on that later? Somebody?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Senator Wilson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Commissioner, perhaps I came in late, but are you going to talk about how you are managing this $10 million deficit? Chair, what you are doing to
yes, that? Madam Chair, Senator, yes, we will.
Thank you.
One of the things that back in 2004 that we attempted as a budget reduction strategy was to double bunk at more extensively at our high security prisons, St. Cloud and Stillwater, and it really has not worked out very well. I think maybe we could pass out, if you would mind, the handout that we have there that talks about capacity at all of the prisons. You'll see by the handout that we are...
We have it.
Okay, multiple... Right, thank you. That we multiple, there's dorms and there's... living areas. So in our prisons at almost every level except our highest security, which is Oak Park Heights, we do have a percent double bunked. And to save money, we were trying to do more of a percent at St. Cloud and Stillwater. It has been horrendous at Stillwater especially, and so we've cut down on the number of double bunk beds. And at this point, I would just like to turn it over to Deputy Commissioner Lynn Dingle. She's been the warden at five of the facilities, and she kind of endured, she and her staff, when they were at Stillwater, she has firsthand experience. So I'd like to turn it over.
Okay. Thank you for coming today. Sure, Senator Foley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, when you were looking at the inmate population, what I could see the numbers that you have in there in current capacity, but it doesn't tell me how much per day. And I would be very interested in knowing how many incidents you might have involving corrections employee in the course of their work there.
Madam Chair, Senator Foley, I know we have that. Working
on that, yeah.
Okay. I'll turn that over to Deputy Commissioner.
Deputy Commissioner, thanks for coming today.
Thank you for having me. Madam Chair, members of the committee, before we go into a video clip, if I could be so rude as to turn my back to you so that I can watch the screen, I'd like to explain to you what's occurring and what you should look for on the screen. It's a couple of shots from different facilities, and it shows some of the incidents that we've had in those facilities. So if we could start the video clip, I'll go fast. We do have a video clip. This is movement at the Stillwater Prison. And we do controlled movement in an effort to keep the smallest number of men together at the same time, not ring out every cell block at the same time. This is our dining hall at Stillwater. We have a concrete wall right down the middle and divide them up. But as you can see, I have one officer in the back there at this time. This is the lining up as they are getting their meals. And you will see some guys say, "Hi, Mom," in the back there. But that's the kind of movement that we have and concerns. This, again, is controlled movement, moving them out to some either program, lunch, gym, whatever the case might be. Watch this video clip very closely to the officer standing with his back to us right now. That was an unprovoked attack, a headbutt, that just moving an inmate from one cell to another. Watch the upper right-hand corner there. And what's just about off camera is an officer who had just had a mixture of hot water and honey thrown in his face. And now the offenders are starting to assault him. You will see some officers first come in from the left-hand side of the screen shortly. And when they're doing this, they're administering chemical irritant. And it's basically having no effect on this group. What he's waiting for, he's already called for we have an incident management system. He's waiting for his backup to show up so that they can go in, and you'll start to see staff coming in. This is the response team showing up. Now they have sufficient numbers. This is a clip out of Stillwater also. It's in one of the cell blocks. These two offenders that are beating up the guy in the middle of them, that was a gang hit. He violated some rule that he shouldn't have, and this is the retaliation for that. And again, what's happening is the officer who notices it first will call for a backup team, a response team, and you'll see them enter into the picture shortly. Quick clip now to another cell block in Stillwater. If you watch the top tier, that is one inmate trying to throw another off the tier. This, again, is in B West of Stillwater, double bunking. Again, this is a pretty serious assault. And at some point, I'll point out, when another inmate walks in, there's a weapon that he's fashioned, some kind of a knife out of some material. And the other thing I'd point out in this one, you can see the number of people. When the staff start coming from both ends, they have to come up a stairwell at the end of the cell block, come all the way down the tier, from both sides, and you're seeing them now. They're spraying chemical irritant. What's unique about this one is after they kind of push the group back off the tier, one of the offenders, one of the staff is trying to bring an offender off the tier, and he turns on the staff with the weapon. And my special investigation fugitive unit person said if that were on the streets, that guy would be dead. And now you're seeing that same person, what he's doing is tossing the knife down to the tier below in order to get rid of the weapon. This is the old segregation unit at Stillwater. They could, many of our old facilities, we don't have the ability to turn off the water, the electricity, things like that. So what they could do is plug up their sinks, their toilets, start flushing, and, you know, it looks like it's a waterfall there. This is a fire. Again, they could save up their items in their room, their papers, their books, whatever, and they would spark off of their electrical outlets to start the fire, toss the fire out on the tier. This is in the segregation unit, and you'll know there's a caging across the top of the, or along the side. That tier is only about as wide for one person to walk straight by. If you walk two people by each other, you have to turn and go side by side. So the point of this is just to point out with the kinds of issues that our great staff in our correctional facilities have to put up with and what they deal with in a very professional manner. This the man that you saw getting, the officer that you saw getting beat up in the corner, the one who had the honey and water thrown in his face, that's a picture of him after that assault. On the left side is a picture of a shirt, an officer's shirt, after urine, feces, and other materials had been thrown on him. These are weapons made by inmates, and no, this is not allowed, not condoned. We don't have a shop making weapons. This is the stuff they can make out of things that you and I would never guess that they could do. And so this is just a board that we've kept the weapons so that we could, when we train in new staff, we can show them the kinds of things to be looking for when we do cell searches and room searches.
Madam Chair, just one small commentary on Deputy Commissioner Dingell's piece of this. A lot of these officers come in and do this for about $30,000 a year, and I think a lot of people don't realize that these are very tough jobs. Now I get to go on to the budget piece of this. This graph.
Ms. Cornelius, would you identify yourself for the tape?
Sorry, Madam Chair. My name is Lisa Cornelius, Assistant Commissioner for Support Services.
Thanks.
This chart will show you the governor's proposed budget for the next biennium. As you can see, the entire public safety division is 5% of the state budget, corrections only being 2.8%. The Department of Corrections, the governor's recommendation of $948 million for the biennium. Please note, 15% of this, 15% of the community services division funding does pass through two counties. I'm going to briefly go over our change items, and then we have people available to answer specific questions. Our first change item is in operational deficiencies. This is a requested dollar amount totaling $22.7 million for the biennium. The total we actually need for this is closer to $42 million, but recognizing the state's precarious budget situation, we did only request $22.7 million. We have unrealized bed savings. Back in the 2003 session, we did say that we would double bunk up to 880 beds at Stillwater in St. Cloud. However, this has proven to be very unsafe for our facilities, and so we have had to only double bunk about 364. The facility designs were not made for double bunking, so that's become a great safety and security issue. Also, in our base budget, we do not have adequate funding for staff. In fact, we're short funding for about 190 staff positions that we currently have that we need to operate the agency.
Ms. Cornelius, would you pull your microphone a little closer, please? I'm having a hard time hearing you.
Certainly.
Oh, thank you.
And Senator Rosen did ask earlier how we were managing that $10 million deficit this year. It has not been without pain. In fact, it's been with a lot of pain. We were only able to fund our salaries at 96%, and typically it's around 98%. We've had to keep positions vacant for very, very long periods of time. I have a couple instances. I was at St. Cloud at a meeting about a month ago, and they talked about how there was a sink that was running, had running water in it for about a day and a half because they've not hired a plumber. because they're having to save money. So we're not getting maintenance, daily maintenance things accomplished, and actually even bigger maintenance projects accomplished, especially in our older facilities. I know the Oak Park Heights prison has had to modify their offender programming on 30 different shifts in the month of December. There was a week, I think, three times in 1 week where offenders did not get recreation. And this may not sound like a big deal to some people, but when you're an offender in prison, your rec time is really, really important. And I think sometimes we're putting our prisons in really dangerous situations when we can't do the things that we need to do. I want to make sure that people understand that when we are talking about the salary deficiency, we are not talking about any increases for across-the-board increases that may come up in the next biennium. This is just to cover our current staffing level. The next change item is for the Corrections Employees Retirement Plan. It is removing approximately 800 positions out of this early retirement. It's focused on providing this benefit to Correctional Officer Series employees only. It removes all other staff that have fallen under this plan based on their 75% offender contact during their work shift. This has been a very, very agonizing decision, and we did this in order to try to retain staff positions that we need to run the agency. It also changes the requirement for security staff to have 10 years of continuous service in this plan in order to be eligible for the medical insurance. If you look at the bottom bullet, it does talk about the contribution of the state to be 11.1% in 10, 12.1% in 11, and compared to the general plan of 4.75 and 5% in those years.
And is that a negotiated contribution, or how is that derived?
Yeah. The employment contribution, I got to back up. In order to get in the plan is statutory language. The medical insurance part is negotiated through the labor unions. I believe the pension people determine the rates.
I think we'll come back and talk about this proposal in quite a bit of detail because this is hugely problematic. If that's okay, we'll go ahead and hear the rest of this and then we can come back to any of these items.
The next slide is to talk about the reducing pass-through funding. And the Community Services Division looked at core public safety here, and the first thing they did was look at, is this providing supervision services for offenders? And then they looked at whether or not they were providing for higher-risk offenders, what the services were in the community for higher-risk offenders, and then they looked to determine if it was a statewide program. And so through this cut, the day reporting services for selected offenders in Hennepin and Ramsey counties, and what they do is monitor lower-risk offenders released from prison, providing pre- and post-release services with community providers. There's the 8-day temporary juvenile hold facilities in specific counties, and then there is grant funding for restorative justice activities. We have a change item for a reduction in dental services. This will reduce dental services for offenders. They will receive a screening at intake, and we will have two dental teams traveling among facilities to address emergency needs. Any urgent dental needs will have to be provided through contracted services. This will eliminate almost 15 FTEs. We also have an operations support services.
Just a second. Senator Rosen.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. The FTEs, currently you have one per one at each facility, a dental hygienist or a dentist. What are the FTEs, can I ask?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, we do have dental services at all facilities, and I can ask our Health Services Director Nan Larson to come up and address those specific questions.
Welcome. If you'd identify yourself for the tape, please.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name's Nanette Larson. I'm the Health Services Director for the Department of Corrections. Senator Rosen, as Ms. Cornelius mentioned, We do have dental services at all of our institutions. We have dental clinics just like you or I would go to. They're staffed by a combination of dentists and dental assistants, dental hygienists. Some institutions we use hygienists because it seemed like a better fit for us, but most often they assist the dentist anyway. So we have about 25 FTEs currently of dentists, dental assistants, and hygienists.
Other questions on the dentist piece?
Madam Chair.
Senator Foley.
Madam Chair, and whoever we deal with, it seems to me that the dental type of thing is kind of an ongoing thing that some people have neglected their teeth for years, and then when they get in the institution, they get some dental service, but it tends to be more in extractions rather than other types of dental work. Is that what's going on in the system today?
Madam Chair and Senator Foley, we do extractions, but we also try and maintain the teeth through fillings and such if that's what the dentists believe that we should be doing. We certainly don't want to extract teeth if they can be saved.
Is current practice that everybody would have a checkup once a year, or is current practice now just emergencies?
Madam Chair, we have a policy that prioritizes our dental services. Emergent and urgent dental needs are serviced first. Emergent things are uncontrollable pain, swelling, bleeding. Urgent would be something like an excision of a tumor, maybe some dental injuries that might have occurred through a fight. Routine care, such as you're talking about, like cleanings or fillings, would fall under our routine care. When an offender has been serving at least 12 months with us, they can go on a centralized waiting list. And as they get to the top of that waiting list, they become eligible for that routine care. They end up having to pay a $3 copay, and then they can see the dentist for that routine care. They don't have to come to us. It certainly is voluntary. They ask for that routine care. And we certainly don't ask them to come back on a yearly basis. They would have to sign up again for that routine care every year. And if we get to them, we get to them. And if we don't, we don't. But we prioritize our services based on emergent and urgent needs first.
And so this proposal would now get rid of the routine care, as you called it, and it would be only urgent care?
Madam Chair, that's kind of what we are believing, is that there would be very, very little routine care. It would certainly depend on the scheduling and the other needs that the dentists are facing at the institution. But I'm betting that very little routine care would occur. But you have to remember, I think our average length of stay is about 22 months. And even to be eligible for routine care, you have to have been with us for at least 12 months. So there's really only about a 10-month period of time on average for which they might not be receiving those routine services. And if it turns into an emergency, we would have that circuit riding team, dentist, provide that service, or we would have those services provided through a community dentist.
So you have two teams in eight facilities, not including Red Wing and Appleton. So they would be there like a team would be at each facility like once a week.
Madam Chair, what we're proposing is that we would maintain our dentists and our dental teams at our intake facilities. I'm sorry. So at St. Cloud, Shakopee, Red Wing. And then those circuit riding teams would service the remaining six. So depending on the size of the institution, they may go to Stillwater, for example, twice a week, and Oak Park Heights maybe once every other week. So depending on the size and the need.
Okay. The questions on the dental piece? Okay, continue, please.
Our last change item is a reduction in operation support services, and this essentially is our central office, finance, human resources, information technology, policy and legal services, employee development, the Office of Diversity. Our staffing levels over the past few years have already been reduced as we've centralized, regionalized, and consolidated services. An example of this is, I believe, since 2001 or 2002, we've reduced over 45 positions just in financial services as we've regionalized our activities there. We will continue to streamline services and create efficiencies with technology and centralization.
So, Senator Mwah?
Madam Chair, I'm a little bit confused about the operations support division. Does each facility have their own operations support services division, or is this at the administrative office?
Ms. Cornelius?
Madam Chair, Senator
Commissioner Blanc. Cornelius, I'm sorry.
We actually, all the budget for these areas are in our central office. Dependent on the activity will depend on if there are people at the facility or not. We have financial services in regions, so not every facility has financial staff at their facility. For example, we have a region of Oak Park Heights, Stillwater, and Red Wing, and all the financial services staff are housed at Stillwater. Our human resources for that region are housed at Oak Park Heights. We do have IT people in every facility, but they're managed out of central office. They're more the day-to-day, let's make sure our computers are working. The Office of Diversity does not have people in every facility. Employee development maybe has one and a half in each facility.
Senator Engelbretson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm not sure who would answer this, but the incidents with regards to the guards getting injured, what percentage of increase are you seeing in over the past 10 years, for instance? Are you seeing an increase to assaults?
Madam Chair, Senator
Dingell?
The best I can give you is we noticed spikes at different types of times of the year. For instance, at Stillwater during the summer, we noticed spikes of more incidents. When we were double bunking at the beginning of 2004, it really spiked high. And then once we started not doing as many double bunks in that B West unit, it did reduce a lot. But overall, we have noticed a gradual increase of incidents, assaults of staff, and it's hard to pin down one thing that causes that, but it's many things, and some of it is the double bunking, some of it is the crowding, some of it is the gang activity that has been increasing, and sometimes that spills from the streets over into the prison and vice versa. So I would say yes, it has increased.
Thank you.
Commissioner, how many people work at the central office? Commissioner Cornelius?
Madam Chair, with our MinCor, which is their central office is there too, I believe it's right around 270, 280.
And how many people worked in the central office, say, 10, 12 years ago?
Madam Chair, we'll have to get back to you with that information. I don't know that off the top of my head.
I would appreciate that. Thank you.
And, Madam Chair, if I may add one thing too, our central office also includes many people in the Community Services Division, the Risk Assessment Community Notification Unit, the Grants and Subsidy Unit, work release people. So there's a chunk of those people that also work in the Community Services Division.
If you could give us a breakout of those when you get a minute, that would be appreciated. Okay. I had said at the beginning of the committee that we would do about half of the meeting on DOC and half on public safety, and I think I have enough questions to fill out the rest of this hearing just on DOC. Okay. All right. I think what we'll do, since all of the public safety folks are here, let's see if we can wrap up this part of it in the next 10 minutes or so, and then next week we'll have folks come back and give us more detail on these various ideas. I'm very interested in getting more information on the retirement plan, and I would like to have an opportunity to ask some of the folks whose retirement plans are affected to come talk to us, because I think we need to know a lot about this project. for this proposal.
Madam Chair.
Senator Foley.
Madam Chair, we might check with staff to see whether this is a bargainable thing under PELRA, or what. It seems to me that they don't bargain over insurance.
Okay.
And so that may not be the person that we're looking at.
All right. And I would like Senator Berglund to be here, too, because the MSOP, this affects the MSOP employees as well. So I think we'll set that for one of the days next week. But if we have maybe 10 minutes to ask other questions on this this proposal. In looking at it, I'll wait until we get the information about the central office, but it seems to me that in these trying times, possibly the central office could have taken a larger reduction to keep some other things happening in the institutions.
Madam Chair.
Which of you? Senator Moore, I'm sorry.
Well, you know, Madam Chair, that being said, I do wonder, I mean, at what point do we reduce and consolidate so much, whether in the central office or elsewhere, that we, in essence, have rendered ourselves incapable of functioning? So, I mean, I one of my concerns is at what point? I mean, do we go to 3 days of operation? You know, do we go to, I mean, those are some of the things that I would be interested in. In hearing is an assessment. I see a pattern here that we've reduced. And at some point, will we be able to, I understand these individuals at the table down here might not be able to make that assessment for us, but at some point, do we around this table have a conversation about at what point does that reduction get to a point where you kind of say it's, you know, you keep the lights on, but our people are going to be able to be around in the hallways to make the place mm-hmm. run. I mean, I think that's some of the hard discussions that we're going to be needing to have.
Mm-hmm. And then also the idea that we're not funding salaries to the level we're supposed to. I didn't quite understand that, but, you know, we probably need to know what the ramifications of all of that are. Are we not funding it because we don't have people in those positions right now? Or did people not get raises or kind of what? Yeah. That's another issue that's kind of related to that same cut thing. Senator Rosen.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and that's exactly the direction I was going.
Okay.
And with that, I think, honestly, I don't know, Commissioner. Is there union contracts involved in the corrections?
Oh, yes.
And we should probably have a full disclosure on that as far mm-hmm. as the contracts that need to be honored, or you, it says here that you're not does not include the across the board salary increase. We need to honestly talk about where your union contracts sit right now, too.
Are you in the process of negotiations of contracts now, or when does that begin for the next biennium?
Madam Chair, I believe the Department of Minnesota Management and Budget is just in the preliminary stages of gathering information to start negotiations.
So the negotiations that they're doing now are for this coming biennium that we're working on?
Madam Chair, correct.
Okay. Senator Foley?
Madam Chair, I think the issue here to start with is the safety of these employees. Mm-hmm. It just strikes me as that we have cut, and we're really not providing for the safety of that. I look at a recent article in the paper and one on television where a former Viking football player beat up on two Minneapolis police officers, and when you look at the size of the individuals that are there, that they need all the help they can get, and so I want this committee to keep that in mind, is that our employees are important.
Well, that's, you know, that's one of the things that comes into play on the retirement benefit as well, because a lot of people aren't guards, but they have a lot of time being spent in their day with the offenders, And one would say they spend more time with the offenders than the guards do. And so, the idea that the corrections officers would continue to get the benefit, but all these other people who work in those institutions who have daily contact with people wouldn't, I think we need to work through that as a group as well. Commissioner, I had one question on the occupancy chart that you gave us. It seems to me just a couple of weeks ago we were told that the Challenge Incarceration Program had about 50-some empty beds, but this says 100% occupancy.
Madam Chair, this is really to show, if it's double bunked or if it's multiple occupancy. It isn't the current population. It's the current capacity. So the Challenge Incarceration Program can take 146 people, but they have 95. I put this together to show you that we double bunk or, have dorms in this percentage of the, of our facilities.
So this is the number of people who are double bunked? Is that what this is saying?
Right. This is the current capacity is how many beds at that particular institution. The percent is how many of those are not private, not single cells.
Okay, so at the Challenge Incarceration Program, 100% of
they're in a big dorm.
Yeah.
But it isn't, the current capacity. It isn't the current number that are there.
Boy, that's a totally different table than what I read it the first time. Okay, thank you all for coming today. We'll be talking to you next week again.
Thank you very much.
Senator Foley.
Madam Chair, I'd like to have some data on the number of gang members, and also might be helpful to determine whether there's inmate sexual offenses that arise out of their incarceration.
Madam Chair, that was the number of sexual offenses or on staff?
Or staff also.
And assaults, did you also want that?
Yes, please.
Okay, Senator Moore.
Madam Chair, in terms of the reduction in pass-through funding, are we going to have an opportunity to hear from is there going to be an impact on counties, I guess, the counties?
Oh, sure there will be.
And so we're going to have an opportunity to hear what that cost impact is going to be.
Yes. And I expect we probably want to talk or hear from the restorative justice folks as well.
Yes.
On the effects that cut would be. And I don't know enough about the 8-day temporary juvenile holds and the day reporting services, so we'd probably want some information on that.
Madam
as well.
Chair, if I may, I really, in trying to put this together, I really spent a lot of time with the governor's office and, putting this together to try to preserve as much of the money for corrections pass-through. There's $147 million in the biennium, and this is, a very small cut out of that money. The rest of it for treatment, for supervision, intensive supervision, caseload reduction money. There's a number of categories, and it totals in the biennium $147 million. So that, is preserved. So I just want you to, look at it with that as well. So,
all right. Well, we will be asking those groups in those counties. And then I think Senator Ingebrigtsen wanted to talk about short-term offenders, and we haven't had. And if you'll prepare something for our next meeting on that. Okay? Thank you so much. Department of Public Safety is next. We have several folks on our agenda. And I think Assistant Commissioner Leslie is on the hot seat.
I have to prioritize better than this.
And we have a new handout coming out around.
Madam Chair and members, good afternoon. I'm Tim Leslie, Assistant Commissioner, and Commissioner Campion's unavailable today. With me today is Jared Jordahl, Legislative Affairs Director and Strategic Planning, Frank Ahrens, Administrative Services Director of our Budget, Department of Public Safety initiatives are heard before both the Public Safety Committees and the Transportation Committees. Today we will be focusing more, of course, on the divisions that report through this committee. However, we will be talking about all our divisions. All the division directors are here. They will come forward when I talk about their budgets, and they will give a short 2 to 3 minute presentation about their activities, performance measures, and outcomes of their divisions as well. Thank you for inviting us, and we look forward to this opportunity. This presentation is for you, so don't hesitate to stop me at any time, and I'll answer any questions I can. We do have 3 budget change items as well, and those division directors will address those as they go through it. Okay. We'll be going off of the PowerPoint that you have passed out. A lot of people consider a mission statement to be just words, but an effective organization must know exactly what they hope to accomplish and determine the direction by using the mission statement as a compass. At the Department of Public Safety, our mission is more than just words. It is our culture. We want our employees to know that every day-to-day decision that they make could and should be based on our mission and our strategic goals. Very simply put, we are required to protect Minnesotans regardless of where they are or what they are doing 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. We watch the news at night, the stories about identity theft, fire death, traffic fatalities, victimization, terrorist threats. We view those differently at public safety because our staff and our culture supports our mission to make Minnesota safer. The governor has recommended no cuts to the Department of Public Safety's budget. This is our biennial budget base. It's a little more than $615 million. One-third of it is from the general fund. One-third of it is from the trunk highway fund. And the remaining portion, or about 40%, is from special revenue accounts. The expenses by category. When you examine the $615 million budget, 88% of it is spent in 3 ways. Number one, total compensation. That's the compensation for our 2,000 employees is 47% of the expenses. Our operating expenses, basically the things we need to support our mission and the people we employ, cars, fuel, technology, rent, that's 26%. Local assistance, which are grants to nonprofits and other government entities, that's 15%. So now we're at 88%. Also included in our expenses by category are transfers. Within that category, $55 million of that is related to the 911 special revenue account and is for the build-out of the statewide public safety radio system. The last category is payments to individuals. This is the health care coverage account for disabled public safety officers and the bullet-resistant vest reimbursement account that we manage at the Department of Public Safety. I want to comment briefly. In your budget books, you will see some sections of the 10 and 11 base that shows a reduction in FTEs. To help you understand that we've been building this budget since the summer, of course, and we use assumptions mostly from when we started building it, and that was in the summer. And we built in some added labor costs, and as you know, that without an increase in funding to fund those labor costs, we are required to hold positions open to pay for those increased costs. With the salary freeze now, those numbers are actually deflated. And I want to assure you that this budget as submitted will not result in any layoffs of any people from public safety. Do we need any more clarification of that, Madam Chair?
Any questions on that? Okay, go ahead.
The next one is the budget summary. This slide requires some clarification also. If you look on page 7 of your budget documents, you'll note on the right-hand side, you will see that, in fact, we had a 10% decrease in the general fund. What that is that's one-time money that comes to the Department of Public Safety through the biennium, federal funds or state funds. We can't build that back into our budget for 10 and 11. So that shows a 10% decrease. However, we also had an increase in special revenue funds. That's namely the 911 account to pay for the debt service on the bonds we sold to build the radio system. So that's why you'll see this 1% increase. These are the divisions within the Department of Public Safety that get their funding from this committee. All the division directors, like I stated, are here and will be addressing the committee. Speak to their divisions. These are the divisions of public safety who get their funding from the Transportation Finance Committee divisions, Senator Murphy and Representative Leader, respectively. I'll briefly speak to these divisions before getting into the other public safety divisions that report to this committee. First one is the Minnesota State Patrol. It's, of course, led by Colonel Mark Danaski. Go ahead, please. Their mission, protect and serve all people in the state through assistance, education, enforcement, provide support to allied agencies, provide the safe and efficient movement on the traffic, the roadways. Their annual operating budget for 2009 was $82 million with 954 full-time equivalents. Our governor's proposing for the 10 and 11 biennium, $158 million, $328 from the Trunk Highway Fund, and $184 from the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund, and $6.3 million from the General Fund. You can see from the State Patrol, we have a wide variety of services that they provide to accomplish their mission. Next up is Driver and Vehicle Services. They are led by Pat McCormick. They subscribe to the acronym FAST, Fair, Accurate, Secure, and Timely for their mission. They have an annual budget of $55 million, 534 employees working in 98 locations across the state. They collect approximately $1 billion in state revenue annually. It's funded by a special revenue fund and highway user tax distribution fund. As you can see, they have those are the services they provide to the people of the state of Minnesota. Office of Traffic Safety, led by
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Assistant Commissioner Leslie, on this FAST or the mission, can you give me a little more information, or give us a little more information on this? And can some of these services be done more efficiently, such as more electronically? I don't know, this collection of data, and I mean, is there room to consolidate and make this a little more efficient, this area?
Commissioner Leslie.
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen. Right now, a lot of the things that driver and vehicle services do can be done online. You can renew your driver's license and your tabs online. Mm-hmm. You can renew your tabs online. Yeah. You can't renew your driver's license online. Pat McCormick is here if you want to get into some specifics.
Although this isn't in our division, so this is in Senator Murphy's division, this piece of public safety.
That's right.
It's probably why we haven't talked much about it.
Okay. Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
All I know is that I have heard that this is possibly an area that could be maybe a little more fine-tuned, and we could perhaps make this utilize the resources we have out there better.
Okay.
That's how I've been told.
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, thank you. Duly noted, we have a turnaround issue at times there, but Pat McCormick does a heck of a job trying to get everything moving in the right direction to get it as low as possible in terms of days. Office of Traffic Safety is led by Cherie Marty. Their mission is to move Minnesota towards zero death on our freeways and roadways. They use the four E's, education, engineering, enforcement, and emergency medical services. They're driven by data, best practices, and research. Their funding is a $435,000 appropriation from Trunk Highway, which allows them to then get grants of $28 million annually from the federal government to do their program areas, which is next up. Right here to Safe and Sober, Click a Ticket. These are the other program areas that they do also. And the last Trunk Highway-funded agency is administration-related services. This is the support of the division.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And with regards to the Office of Traffic Safety, leveraging federal funds, do you see that going away at all or reducing, or what's the word?
Chair Leslie.
Madam Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, we are not hearing anything that would say that that's going down. Although the stimulus package has not been announced, we're monitoring those things daily to see.
Thanks.
There is public safety dedicated money in this stimulus package.
So I'm reading well.
I don't know what it is other than some OJP money, I know.
Programming, I think.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Proposed, anyhow.
We'll Thank take you. Whatever money they send us mm-hmm. in this division.
Madam Chair, next up is State Fire Marshal Office. The mission of the State Fire Marshal is protect lives, protect property by fostering a fire-safe environment. The Fire Marshal is Mr. Jerry Rosendahl, and he's got a few comments, if you don't mind.
Welcome.
Madam Chair and members, the Office of State Fire Marshal was created in 1905 and charged with the responsibility of investigating the origin, cause, and circumstances of fires and maintaining fire incident reports submitted by local fire departments. Responsibilities have obviously been increased over the past 104 years. Funding for the Fire Marshal Division no longer comes from the general fund. Approximately 70% comes from special revenue direct appropriations via the relatively new fire safety account, and approximately 30% from fees and contracts per special revenue statutory appropriations. The fire safety account provides funding for the State Fire Marshal Division as well as the Minnesota Board of Firefighter Training and Education for firefighter training and grants for fire-related projects that have the potential for statewide impact. Estimated revenue for the fire safety account for the biennium is $16 million. Once appropriated, the Fire Service Advisory Committee makes a recommendation to the Commissioner of Public Safety on how to spend the fire safety account. Quarterly collections from insurance companies were first due into this account in November of 2007. $2.268 million is annually transferred to the general fund to replace the amount that was formerly collected as a fire insurance tax. And just a note, the Minnesota Board of Fire Training and Education last week released their initial request for reimbursement applications to the fire departments across Minnesota. And they have $850,000 approximately available in this first round of money for fire training across the state. Requests are expected to greatly exceed the amount of money available, but that is the amount they have running. In terms of fire marshal services, our fire investigators assist local fire and law enforcement agencies with the origin and cause investigation of fatal fires, obvious arson fires, fires of suspicious nature, multiple injury, and large dollar loss fires and explosions. In 2008, 480 investigations were conducted by our staff. We also develop and enforce the state fire code, conducting fire inspections in healthcare facilities, correctional facilities, public and charter schools, daycare facilities, and motels. And approximately 3,500 inspections and re-inspections are conducted annually in those areas. And we also deal with fire code training for local fire and building officials. We regulate those persons who manufacture, assemble, warehouse, or store explosives or blasting agents for purposes of wholesale or retail sale. We regulate the fire protection industry through licensing of contractors and certification of sprinkler fitters. We also certify the operators of public fireworks displays. And the newest one, we certify all cigarette brand styles that are sold in Minnesota as being fire standard compliant. And I do have a trivia question for you, Madam Chair. How many different brand styles of cigarettes are currently certified with us? I'll give you the answer in a minute. Under the governor's executive order, for state agencies, the division responds to disasters or emergencies that require coordination of fire services beyond the daily operations. We have stepped up our involvement in assisting local fire officials with major incidents and currently are working with Homeland Security and Emergency Management in supporting a rapid needs assessment team for disasters. Our new online Minnesota Fire Incident Reporting System collects data from the state's 788 fire departments, typically over 200,000 incidents annually. This online version is provided free of charge to local fire departments, which can save each department hundreds of dollars per year because they don't have to purchase and upgrade commercial software. Public education, as you all know, is the key to reducing fires and fire deaths. Our office acts as a resource for local fire officials who don't have the staffing to do this. And the I know you have the answer, Madam Chair, but the answer to the trivia question is there are currently 798 brand styles of cigarettes certified to be sold in Minnesota. Now, quickly, just that number does usually get to people. Amazing.
Wow. Okay, everybody who does an online newsletter for the weekend, there's your trivia piece.
798 different brand styles of cigarettes.
Who could name more
than
10?
Fire standard compliant.
Okay. Thanks.
The just quickly, the Office of Pipeline Safety is not the budget is not go through this division, it is co-located in the Fire Marshal Division. And the State Fire Marshal serves as the Director of Pipeline Safety. MNOPS, as it's called, was created in 1987 following a major pipeline release that ignited and caused a fatal fire. And in terms of the services, I'm going to try to highlight this, but the Office of Pipeline Safety inspects natural gas and hazardous liquid pipelines that run throughout Minnesota, coming in and out from Alaska, Canada, Texas, other points throughout the country. Nearly 300 inspections of pipeline companies were done in 2008. And in 2009, there are several major pipeline projects, including nearly 900 miles of large-diameter, high-pressure interstate hazardous liquid pipeline and nearly 80 miles of large-diameter, high-pressure intrastate and interstate natural gas transmission. And the final trivia question for you is how many miles of pipeline are there in Minnesota? I'll give that to you in a second. We also enforce the damage prevention law known as Gopher State One Call, Call Before You Dig. The combination of enforcement actions and prevention education has contributed to a reduction of damages to gas and electric facilities by nearly 70% since 1996. Like the State Fire Marshal Division, there's no general fund money in the pipeline safety budget. The trivia question answer is there are over 65,000 miles of pipeline in Minnesota.
Senator Ingredson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Of those 65,000 miles, what's the current condition of those? I know in Minnesota the pipes rise with the frost just like rocks do. What are we in good condition or not?
The Madam Chair and Senator, through the office, monitoring new construction as well as the inspecting the records of the pipeline safety companies on their routine inspection, they flow or put pigs or whatever they call them through to monitor the thickness, and they check all those kinds of things. By and large, there are the failures in terms of the pipeline are very low. Most all of the damages that we see in leaks or in explosions, fires, or releases are caused by third-party digging, excavating.
Right. Senator Moore.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Rosenau, what's the relationship between our state fire marshal and the local fire, departments?
Madam Chair, Senator Ma, the relationship, I think, is a very close one. We, generally speaking, are providing the services that they don't provide at the local level. We don't do any firefighting. Obviously, they do that. But in terms of fire inspections, code enforcement, fire investigations, there's no duplication of services there. We routinely are called in to help them with complex cases or fire investigation or on difficult code questions because we have staffing that are out there, all the time doing that. So we work very closely with them. We try to, like in the online MFERS system, our efforts at a state level are going to save thousands of dollars across the local fire department's level because of that system. And that's just one example. We work with them to train and encourage and train local fire investigation teams at a countywide or a region-wide level, and then we support them. So we try to find every opportunity we can to collaborate with them and work with them.
Madam Chair.
Senator Ma.
Well, I have become increasingly concerned that in these budget difficult times, we are shifting a lot of the burden to local government. And some of the areas that are going to take some hit as local governments start to look at their local budgets is fire and police at the local level, which to a large extent is, I think, a core function of what local government delivers. I am very concerned, not just in the metro area, actually, but it's actually in the greater Minnesota area where we've got a larger geographic area to cover. I wondered if your office has any perspective for us in terms of the adequacy of the type of coverage that we've got throughout the state of Minnesota.
Madam Chair and Senator, at two recent Board of Directors meetings, the State Fire Chiefs Association and State Fire Department Association, a considerable period of time was spent there discussing the local impact and things like that. But we also, we brought in a discussion and started a discussion on shared services and to try to get them to look at some of these things. There are 788 fire departments in this state. And I have dared to say to them in the past that in 10 years we'll have 100 fewer fire departments, because I think the days of being able to maintain at the local level that many fire departments are probably numbered. And it isn't about getting rid of fire departments. My push is just to get them to look at if one department can specialize in rescue and another department specialize in hazardous materials and another department provide a training officer that goes around and share these kinds of services, they'll be better off. They'll reduce their costs.
I'm looking on the budget book on page 56, right in there. It looks like you're adding about 5 FTEs in the fire marshals department. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, the FTEs you see there are basically a formula or a product of the budget numbers that are put into the compensation or the salary line. We have that funding through the fire safety account from the Fire Service Advisory Committee that they've pushed through, and that's the number that Mr. Aarons can probably that doesn't necessarily relate exactly to what we have currently.
Okay. And you said they were paid for by the fire safety account. They're not general fund.
Correct.
Okay. Senator Ingebrigtsen?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a general question. Is it your feeling, getting back to Senator Moore's issue here with consolidating and things, and I think that's a good idea, is it your feeling that especially in the rural areas, probably more so, the public safety director type situation where you have different stations of fire departments versus all these little fire departments? Is that kind of where we're going, or is that a good suggestion?
Madam Chair and Senator, I think that the concept is a county, maybe a countywide fire chief. I know there's a couple counties that have actually done that, where you centralize some of the more administrative duties and paperwork, things like that, and maybe go together on something like that. Or they have a countywide training officer that could go around and do some things like that. In terms of public safety, I don't know if you're referring over to, police and fire joint situations. Certainly there are a few of those out there, too. But I'm more looking, fully at the shared services of fire departments.
Follow-up. And what I'm wondering is there any studies out there done, or are we looking at any studies as to what savings we could have statewide to help the counties out, small towns out that might be losing their... I guess that's their footprint, too. It's like a school. You lose your fire department, that's also part of the little city.
Madam Chair and Senator, I'm not aware of any studies that are done that are at that more local level. I am aware of a couple of fairly decent-sized cities that combined two cities into one fire department and are saving several hundred thousand dollars when you get into the staffing issue. On a small rural fire department, their budget may be $2,000-$5,000 for the whole year. I mean, a lot of the volunteer salaries or no pay at all. So there it's as much an issue of recruiting and retaining people with the training requirements that we have and OSHA standards and the cost of gear and things like that than it is just a time issue.
Senator Ingebrigtsen?
Just one more, and I'll be quiet. Is it still the regulation or state law that, or the feeling, maybe that's what it is, that used fire trucks cannot be handed down to other departments?
Used
fire trucks from a larger department cannot be handed down to a smaller department?
Madam Chair and Senators and members, the issue there is on the liability, civil liability of providing used equipment to another department. There are issues with that, and I know that the fire service has that as an issue there. I think bringing forward this session to try to clarify that, because we have fire trucks and a lot of protective gear and things like that, safety equipment, mm-hmm. that are going to Mexico and other countries as opposed to other fire departments in Minnesota that could use that.
Senator Wall?
Well, you know, Madam Chair, I think some of the issues of consideration is that, first of all, in some of our rural communities, most of our firefighters are volunteer, so they have a full-time job somewhere. And if an incident happens and you put in the call, you're not quite sure who's available to come to fight the fire. Plus, I think that one of the things that we should appreciate about this discussion about consolidation of services as we look at efficiency, too, is the response time. Because I know that when we were looking at courts and reducing court unit, at some point, geographically, you have to have a presence or else you're not going to be able to physically get a fire engine out to a location in time. You know, I mean, the response time. I mean, how do you get there the quickest? So even though there is may not from a from an incident, number of incidences perspective, I mean, we may not be able to justify the maintenance of a fire station, but in terms of the geographic coverage and the maintenance time, that has to be taken into consideration. And I think that, you know, there certainly is room for some creativity as we think about consolidation of administration, thinking about fire chiefs and things like that, but then there's actually the physical infrastructure of having a fire engine hooked up to some water that will respond, that at some point that becomes the structural and response time issue for consideration. And I think sometimes we forget that when we talk about consolidation.
I know that there's a lot of work that goes back and forth. I know the Minneapolis Fire Tower gets, mm-hmm. you know, used by a lot of the smaller departments throughout the state, and you know, hazmat teams go here and there from, you know, when they're called, regardless of where they're stationed. And you know, I think our state's departments work together mm-hmm. pretty well, and so we'll be interested in kind of keeping up on what you know on that. Remind us how many of our fire departments are volunteer.
Out of the, Madam Chair, the members, the 788 fire departments are out there, about 90% of them are volunteer. 90% of the 20,000 firefighters are volunteer, so about 18,000.
See, I think last year I asked how many were professionals and then immediately had to bite my tongue yeah. because they're, the better phrase was how many are volunteer. So, okay, anything more on fire marshal and, well, pipeline safety is not ours, but thanks for the update on that piece of it.
Madam Chair, members, next up we're going to talk about the Alcohol and Gambling Enforcement Division. Their mission is to maintain the integrity of legalized gaming, detect and vigorously pursue illegal forms of gambling, enforce the state's liquor laws, and monitor the state and tribal gaming compacts. Their services they offer on the alcohol enforcement side is they license and permit the alcohol beverages. Everyone that comes through this state must be receive an approval through our Alcohol and Gambling Enforcement Division, brand label registration, investigate alcohol-related complaints, alcohol promotion and advertising. They impose civil penalties on users, enforcement of the underage drinking law, and the latest thing we've been doing is a retail alcohol vendor enforcement program. The division is led by John Willems, and he can talk briefly about some of the things they have going on. Gambling enforcement is also a division there. They're divided into two sides of the house. The gambling enforcement side licenses manufacturers and distributors of gaming equipment. They assure compliance with the state and tribal compacts, and they they also do gambling criminal enforcement and investigations.
And members, I think the budget book, starting on page 85, is the alcohol and gambling enforcement.
Their budget proposed, the governor's proposing a budget in the next biennium of $1.685 million a year out of the general fund and $903,000 a year out of special revenue direct appropriations. There is a budget change item as well included in this budget. And Mr. John Willems will talk about that.
Okay, welcome, Mr. Willems.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I am John Willems. I am the director of the Alcohol and Gambling Enforcement Division. And as been said, generally captured, our division exercises regulatory and law enforcement authority over legal and illegal alcohol and gambling activities within Minnesota. We are the sole state agency responsible for, with responsibility for the alcohol industry, and the sole state agency with law enforcement authority over gambling. In the area of gambling, we also do perform some regulatory functions, generally as they relate directly or indirectly to tribal gaming. And as Assistant Commissioner Leslie noted, we do have one budget change item, and this item actually reflects what I consider to be, I guess, a simple accounting change, at least simple in my mind. And I say this because it neither increases nor decreases the budget recommendation for the agency. The division issues what are called 2AM permits. Of the fees collected, the agency retains $153,000 annually. This budget change item reflects that $750,000 will now be transferred to the general fund.
And this is on page 11 on your budget books.
And that is what happens with the budget change item. Continuing, I do think we have some positive things to report today, and these are some things that either I would like to just explain a little bit more. I know many of them are mentioned in your budget narratives, and I don't want to repeat everything that's in there in the essence of time. So I'll offer these in summary format, and then if you would have any questions, be happy to respond. 2 years ago, and formally launched this past November, the division's No More Minnesota Nice campaign and the minscams.org was launched. The division developed a public-private effort called the Minnesota Fraud Enforcement Partnership, and this is comprised of some 22 entities committed to reducing the impact of online lottery and sweepstakes fraud. We estimate that as much as $30 million is being lost annually to this type of crime in Minnesota, and since launch, we have received about 40,000 complaints. We work with law enforcement across the globe in this effort and have even been successful in recovering some funds in some situations. These crimes often most target the most vulnerable, and those are our elderly. And to personalize this and just to offer as a quick example, our office has just recently received a complaint that one elderly couple in Minnesota has lost over $1.5 million to these types of scams. To help us improve and enlarge the MinScams.org program, we've recently been applying for grants from private foundations. Whether we will be successful is yet to be determined. We have initiated a new enforcement effort to deal with illegal internet or online gambling. This is a new effort for us. Besides being unlawful, we see it as a threat to our legitimate gambling activities and has been, at least publicly, partially blamed for declining gambling revenues within the state. In September, we conducted a joint online gambling investigation with the state of Washington. Those efforts resulted in seizures of $4.8 million in illegal gambling proceeds. You might ask how that's connected to Minnesota, and the key was a small rural Minnesota bank that annually processed some $35 million in wagers for those activities. On the alcohol front, we have initiated this past fall what we call a retail alcohol vendor enforcement program, something we call RAVE. This effort has our agents and liquor investigators working in support of various DWI saturation efforts across the state. Division staff work inside of the established primarily to ensure that underage drinking laws are enforced, as well as those laws prohibiting the serving of alcohol to the obviously intoxicated are being complied with. We also follow up on all DWI arrests with the place of last drink, if we know that, and we provide an immediate presence to any DWI arrest where the blood alcohol is 0.16 or greater, and again, the place of last drink is known. This program has been extremely well received by the industry, the state patrol, and local law enforcement. Along with that, our agency operates a training program funded by a grant from the Office of Juvenile Justice Programs and is directed to the enforcement of underage drinking laws. This program was one of two that did receive national recognition this past summer from that entity. We've also just initiated a process with the liquor industry to develop a long-term and effective regulatory solution to what the matter of online or foreign sales and direct shipments of alcohol into Minnesota. Hopefully what we will be able to develop will be able to be applied in some fashion to other regulated industries within the state. To increase our presence in gambling and alcohol industries, we are working more closely than ever with other state agencies that have regulatory roles in them. Through an effort we refer to as coordinated compliance sweeps, We work in partnership with the Department of Revenue, Gambling Control Division, and then both aspects of our division, that being gambling and liquor, in conducting statewide inspections of various locations, offering lawful and other forms of activities regulated by one of these entities. To better equip the front line of alcohol regulation, we have started a new training initiative directed towards local licensing authorities. We have completed the first of these events last month. In the two sessions, we provided comprehensive training to nearly 100 local government employees that deal with the issuance of licenses. This was so well received that we are expanding this program with new sessions to be offered in the March-April timeframe. And while I could talk endlessly about the positive things the division is doing, let me conclude by saying the division is committed to ensuring that in the matters related to alcohol and gambling, that the public interest and the public safety remains paramount.
Thank you. Questions?
Madam Chair, next up will be the Homeland Security and Emergency Management Division. You're familiar with that. Our mission there is to help Minnesota prevent, prepare for, respond to, and recover from natural and human-caused disasters. That division is led by Chris Eide. Chris is unfortunately unavailable today. Her deputy, John Kerr, is here. Their funding is in addition to an extensive program activity. It's a pass-through agency. We have sizable federal grants that go through this agency. They are very astute at turning around these grants quickly. Their general fund budget is $2.514 million per year. All of their funding sources are through federal grants, mostly from FEMA and Homeland Security. In fiscal year 2009, we extended approximately $81 million to 300 local governments and entities. The division is divided into four branches: Field Services Branch, Homeland Security Branch, which consists of the Senior Advisory Council, the Joint Analysis Center, the Urban Area Security Initiative Grant, bomb squads, hazmat response, chemical assessment teams, those kind of services. Preparedness Branch, you can see what that is. A response, recovery, and mitigation branch as well. And lastly, there's a school safety center we've found some federal funding to have. This has been going for about almost 2 years. It creates partnerships with law enforcement and education to prevent school safety violence issues and be prepared to handle any issues that happen in our schools with our most valuable resources, our children. With that, I'll turn it over to Mr. John Kerr.
Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and good afternoon, members. My name is John Kerr. I'm Deputy Director with the Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management. Madam Chair, members, I know that time is very limited here, so I'm going to focus pretty heavily on some of our outcomes achieved and some of our activity measures. We have three budget activities, the first of which is Emergency Management Performance Grant. I believe that narrative starts on page 27 of the budget book. In our disaster recovery program area, in that budget activity, I would mention that in 2008 we applied for and received one presidential declaration of an emergency in response to the I-35W bridge collapse. We also applied for two presidential declarations of a major disaster and received both, one for the 2007 flooding that was so severe in southeast Minnesota, and a second one last year, and unfortunately in largely the same area. Those three disaster events brought our total presidential disaster declaration for the last 12 years up to 20. So I am fond of saying that in Minnesota, the disaster business is a huge business. And I think that's evidenced by the fact that during the past 2 years, we have disbursed over $34 million in federal and state disaster assistance to hundreds of individual applicants. In our preparedness programs area, also in the EMPG budget activity area, we conducted 83 emergency management training classes and 17 school safety training sessions, which involved over 29,000 student contact hours. Moving on quickly to the nuclear plant preparedness budget activity, which I believe starts on page 30. I would mention that in the past 2 years, we conducted two full-scale drills and two full-scale exercises that involved about 431 state and local personnel. We also conducted two so-called hostile action scenario based tabletop exercises in compliance with a new federal requirement that we do so. And we trained about 3,000 state and local government and private sector personnel in preparation for those events. Lastly, I would move on to our third budget activity, which is Community Right to Know, which starts on page 33 of the budget book. We annually receive information regarding the storage use and or release into the environment of certain hazardous materials from about 6,000 facilities in the state of Minnesota that are subject to federal reporting requirements. And we collected in the past 2 years about $1.3 million in fees from those 6,000 facilities. All those fees are deposited directly into the general fund. In terms of some activity measures, just a few highlights here. We did meet our goal of submitting all of our requests for presidential declarations within 30 days of the events, which can be a challenge based upon all the documentation that the federal government requires. We did successfully complete our two full-scale nuclear power plant exercises in the past 2 years with zero deficiencies. Of the more than 2,000 individual activities that were evaluated by the federal government during our 08 exercise, we had only four areas of what are called areas requiring corrective action, which are relatively minor. We've already addressed three of those four, and we will be demonstrating the fourth one during our nuclear power plant exercise coming up this summer. We administered 13 grant programs and managed over 901 grants during the 2 years. While doing so, we met our goal of developing grant contracts and having them out the door within 30 days. We also instituted online reporting for those 6,000 facilities that have to report their use of hazardous materials. And at this point in time, about 95% of those 6,000 facilities are now submitting their documentation, if you will, their reporting information online rather than via the cumbersome and lengthy paper forms that used to have to rely on. A few other items that are not noted at all, I don't believe, in the budget book that I thought I would just touch on. One, we completed the pre-design phase one of the Emergency Management Training Center that the legislature approved last session, and we are waiting now for a contract for an architect and design firm to begin the design phase of that project. Next item, I would mention that all 22 agencies that are affected by the Emergency Management Training Certification legislation that was enacted last year, all 22 are in compliance with that legislation, and we are monitoring that and working with those agencies in that area. Based on the last two presidential disaster declarations that we've had, Minnesota will be eligible to receive about $11 million in hazard mitigation grant program funding, which we will be dispersing. And I would mention that so far this biennium, there have been 180 bomb disposal squad responses and 25 state hazardous materials team responses. Chair members, that's just a very quick summary, and I'm certainly be happy to respond to any questions you might have.
Questions? Senator Ingebretson.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the report. With regards, maybe two questions. With regards to schools, how many bomb threats were in schools? And on that same question or the same topic, with the domestic terrorism that went on in Columbine some years ago, I see you're part of your charge is to develop and maintain school safety planning guides. Has any talk ever been with local law enforcement and going together with SROs there officers in schools. Any talk in moving that direction at all?
Mr. Cook.
Madam Chair, Senator Eakin-Britson, as you may know, the current director, our first director of the School Safety Center, is Wade Setter, who has 28 years' experience in law enforcement in the city of Brooklyn Park, 12 years as the police chief there. So he has many contacts with the law enforcement community in Minnesota and has, I know, interacted with them extensively with respect to the school safety guide that was recently updated this year.
And the question about how many of the bomb threats were in schools?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I have the number of bomb threats. I don't know specifically how many involve schools, but I can certainly obtain that information.
Okay, if you would, that'd be great.
Certainly.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my question is about the Community Right to Know Act, and it says there is $1.3 million in fees that's been collected over the two-year time frame. Could you please tell me, Mr. Kerr, where, if those fees, that fee schedule has, and the amount of the fees has remained stable, or if you've increased those recently? And also, if you could tell me that it covers, does it cover the entire cost of the program? And is there anything left?
Mr. Kerr.
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, there were several sub-questions there, and I'll try to address each of them. Answer to, I think, your first question was, have the fees changed? And the answer is no, they have not. The total fees collected has increased over the years because the number of facilities that are required to report their use of hazardous materials has increased.
Madam Chair. Senator Kerr, could you tell me what a typical fee is?
The smallest fee is $25, and then they go up to, I believe, $500 for an individual facility.
Certainly reasonable. And the second question, Madam Chair.
Sure, go ahead.
Mr. Kerr, was the does that suffice the entire program, and is there any bottom dollars left there? Not that we're going to take them. I'm just wondering if the whole, if this covers the administrative cost and the implementation of the program.
Mr. Kerr?
Right, Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, I guess I should clarify that those fees do get deposited directly in the general fund, so they're not fees that we access. Directly, we receive a direct appropriation.
Man, I hate that. That's annoying, isn't it?
Yeah.
All right. Any other questions for Mr. Kerr?
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, members and Senator Eakin-Britson, regarding your question about the School Safety Center, Director Setter had a conference last year about this time, over 400 law enforcement and school administrators attended. SROs were a big part of that. And they're having another one next week in St. Cloud. And we're anticipating another 400 people to come up there and partner and talk about school safety issues and how we can communicate better and collaborate better to protect our children. So just an update to you.
Okay. Thank you.
Next up will be the Office of Justice Programs. Their mission is to provide leadership and resources to reduce crime in Minnesota, improve the functioning of the criminal justice system, and assist crime victims. This division is led by Ms. Jerry Beauvert. She has a remarkable job. The general fund direct appropriation is $37 million per year. In addition to programming, OJP administers grants to nonprofits, local units of government totaling $47 million annually. Their OJP services are on the next page. You know exactly what they are. Crime Victim Reparations, Crime Victim Justice Unit, grants to local programs. You can read them yourself. I want to make sure to note that state drug task forces are also funded there, as well as the Metro Gang Strike Force. Ms. Beauvert.
Ms. Beauvert, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. I'm thrilled to have this opportunity to tell you good things about the small but mighty crew at the Office of Justice Programs. So I'm just going to give you highlights from the last 2 years of our various work units. Our reparations team that provides compensation for losses as a result of a violent crime have had a steady increase of applications over the last 3 years. This year was no different. We had over 1,800 claims and provided about $3 million in compensation. Despite the increase in claims, the staff improved case processing time, as well as 93% of the people they served indicated their services were very good or fair. Our Crime Victim Justice Unit, which assists in navigating the criminal justice system, as well as investigates violation of crime victim rights, investigated over 97 cases in the past 2 years and had over 3,300 contacts from the community about the justice system. Our training and communications team continued to provide quality crime victims training around the state, but they developed a unique partnership with St. Cloud University to implement the Minnesota Victim Assistance Academy. This is a 40-hour intensive academic program to increase the skills of crime victim service advocates, and we've been graduating 40 to 50 people the last 3 years. They also monitor the VINE system, which is the Victim Information Notification Everyday Automated System that provides real-time change of custody information on all offenders. All but 8 counties are now online, and over 4,000 victims have registered. The website, they've done a lot of work on it this year, has had over 180,000 hits. OGP also supports a crime victim liaison with the Department of Corrections, who provided victim input on over 800 end of confinement review hearings this year. Our Statistical Analysis Center, a mighty crew of two, provides criminal justice and juvenile justice information and research on a variety of criminal justice topics. This year, in partnership with the Department of Education, they've developed a new series of data briefs that are around youth and the state of youth. They're excellent briefs, and they're on our website, and they're called Youth Snapshots, so I encourage you to take a look at them. They also staff the Human Trafficking Task Force and complete the third annual Human Trafficking Report. For the biennium, the grants team administered over 600 grants and 300 amendments to nonprofit, state, and local units of government to prevent and reduce crime and violence, improve the criminal justice system, and serve crime victims. They were assisted through our automated grants online system, WEGO, which has been a tremendous help to all of us. Despite significant reductions in federal funds, these teams still administered over $47 million in grants, which includes services to victims of domestic violence, sexual assault, child abuse and general crime, community crime prevention, youth intervention and prevention, juvenile delinquency programs, gang intervention programs, homeless outreach, the school safety center, squad car cameras, defibrillators, offender reentry, family dependency courts, and the gang and drug task forces. Our grant staff conducted over 110 program administrative site visits, 88 technical assistance site visits, and almost 100 financial desk audits. Our law enforcement team conducted extensive assessments of our 24 gang and drug task forces to ensure fiscal and administrative compliance and best practices operation, and they have developed corrective action plans for the task forces who need improvement, and we are linking them with technical assistance. They also facilitated 22 trainings, professional training, for over 700 officers this year. We're extremely proud of the work that our partners in the field do in accomplishing the objectives of these grants. Thanks again for this opportunity to provide you a brief overview, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Boyer? I think of all the things you do, we probably have more resonance with the programs that you work on because we see them in our communities so much. So thanks for all you do.
Thank you.
Commissioner Leslie.
Madam Chair, members, next up is the Emergency Communication Networks Division. That is our newest division. Prior to about 6 months ago, it was known as the Armor and 911 Program Area. The mission is to utilize emerging technologies to provide the most comprehensive emergency communication networks available by developing professional partnerships and collaborating with our customers. We will deliver customer-focused network solutions that enhance public safety. This division is the governor's recommending $121 million from the 911 emergency services account, special revenue fund for this division for the biennial budget. The services in the 911 side include collecting a monthly fee assessed upon all wired, wireless, and packet-based telecommunications services. Contract with telephone companies to provide the 911 network. Administer grants to public safety answering points, PSAPs. Provide technical assistance to PSAPs, develop a migration strategy for next generation 911, which will be moving our wired 911 system to an internet-based protocol system. continuing on, our armor system is implementing a statewide standards-based shared digital trunk. It's a long one. Digital trunk radio communications network for state and local emergency responders. We're developing our Minnesota's bottom-up local and regional governance structure. Every county is represented in a regional radio board across the state, and then implementing the statewide interoperability program. I'll turn it over to Mr. Wiggins.
Mr. Wiggins, welcome back.
Madam Chair, members, I just want to say I agree with him. I thought we maybe need a little bit of comic relief. I know I appreciate the opportunity. I will keep my comments brief in light of the indulgence the committee gave me a few weeks ago. Again, the ARMOR program seeks to provide infrastructure or resources to allow all emergency responders at any time, at any size event, to be able to communicate with each other. I found the back and forth with State Fire Marshal Jerry Rosendahl quite interesting because there was conversation about collaboration. And really, that's what ARMOR is. It's delivery of a radio communication network that is available for everybody to use. And by virtue of everybody trying to move to a shared platform, you generate significant cost savings for not only state entities but also local entities as well. So ARMOR is collaboration. It is trying to find a better way to do things. I mentioned where we were at 18 months ago. Assistant Commissioner Leslie talked about the development of the regional radio boards. We are a national model for that. I continually get contacted by folks wondering how we did it. As a matter of fact, I have an email from somebody from Idaho that I need to respond to right now. So we have done significant work and really nation-leading work with regard to our local bottom-up governance structure in terms of how to handle these interoperability issues. When I spoke to you about 4 weeks ago, I'd mentioned that there was 20 or more counties either on the system or transitioning to the system. On Wednesday of last week, I learned that Freeborn County, down in the southern part of the state, their county board has voted to transition onto the ARMOR system, and also Aiken County, their county board is seeking to transition to the ARMOR system. So again, this stuff does take time, but we are continually making progress on a month-to-month basis once our studies that we're doing are being completed. I wanted to mention some of the things that we're doing in the 911 area as well. For the last couple of years, we've been working on a overall state strategy and migration plan to a next-generation 911 network, which is an IP-based network. Madam Chair, I know that you've attended some of our core advisory group meetings, and I appreciate you taking some of your time to do that.
It's not really like I understood a single acronym that anybody was saying, but I tried.
It really does get into the weeds, but I think you can respect the amount of work that it takes to be able to move a project like that forward. In addition to developing that state strategy on next generation 911 and all the many benefits that that type of IP network would provide, we're also doing an audit of our existing 911 trunks, the dedicated lines that roll into the public safety answering points. We are going through those and reducing costs where we can. When the 911 network was put in a number of years ago, as you might imagine, it was well over-engineered to be sure that no calls would be dropped or that there'd be busies. And now we've had the opportunity to go back and do traffic analysis studies. And where we can, we're reducing costs by taking those trunk lines out. I wanted to note that the budget documents for this particular division start on page 111 of your budget book. I probably should have mentioned that at the top. And then I also wanted to mention two budget change items that are not in the governor's budget that we're working with the governor's office on. One of them relates to utilizing one-time funds to begin the integration of the next generation 911 project. And the other relates to grants to local governments to help them in the cost to transition to the ARMOR system. Again, we're trying to do what we can to assist local governments in their migration to the ARMOR system. We've identified some one-time funds in the 911 special revenue account for that purpose. So I would expect that we'd have much more information on that, after the February forecast comes out.
Mr. Wiggins, I got the second one written down. What was the first one? Use one-time funds to do what?
Start implementing the next generation 911 network.
Okay.
And Madam Chair, if I may just comment on that, as you know, we can't just drop off the old copper-based network that we have. I mean, there is a migration period in order to move to that next-generation network, and that's what we're seeking to use those one-time funds for.
And they're one-time funds that were generated through the fee from the telephones and that kind of thing?
Madam Chair, that's correct. Each wired line, wireless line, each subscriber through a VoIP provider pays a 65 cent a month fee on each line. That's correct.
Senator Berglund.
So, Madam Chair, how does that make it one time?
Mr. Wiggins.
Madam Chair, members, it's one time because that's the balance that we have in the account right now. One thing that we don't have any ability to control how many telecommunications providers come into the state, and our law requires us to offer them cost recovery for providing the 911 network. So it's one time because that's the funds that are in the fund right now at the end of the biennium, or we're projecting to have in the fund at the end of the biennium.
Madam Chair, will that money show up again in the next biennium because the fee continues?
Mr. Wiggins?
Madam Chair, it is possible, but it is undetermined. What we do know is that if you look at the funds, the increase in funds, we're utilizing funds for debt service on the armor bonds, so we wouldn't expect all of those one-time funds to be available in the next biennium.
Seems odd. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, members, thank you.
Come back.
Yeah.
Senator Ingebretson.
Thank you, Mr. Wiggins. Just maybe this would help clarify. When are the bonds paid for the back of the armor system? When is that those bonds paid up?
Mr. Wiggins, they were just sold, I think.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry I didn't hear the question.
When are the bonds due to be paid off?
We've got a series of bonds. We're still paying for bonds that we let to build the metropolitan area. Those were a collaboration with the Met Council. I believe they expire in 2013. We sold some Phase 3 bonds in 2005 or 6, which are an 11-year term on those bonds. And the series that we just sold, the $42 million that we just sold in November, have a 15-year term. And we expect that the series that we sell this year will have a 15-year term as well.
Senator Bois.
Yeah, Madam Chair, a couple of times today, Mr. Wiggins also repeated with the armor program going sort of statewide at the potential significant savings to local governments in terms of the consolidation of services. And I'm having a hard time putting my arms around that. I'm wondering if any modeling has been done to show that, because again, I mean, I'm just concerned about the proposals to consolidate services and its impact on local government, and I just want to make sure that we are responsible when we talk about truly how much savings there could really be at the local government level for the consolidation of services that we keep saying it's we're going to be creating in savings for local government with some of this stuff. And I'm wondering, Mr. Wiggins, if you guys had taken a look at it, if some modeling has been done to indicate that.
Madam Chair and Senator Mouad, very good question. I can tell you a study that was done by the Statewide Radio Board about 4 years ago. And the study looked at if each entity went out and replaced their radio communication system with a state-of-the-art system, the total cost to do that across the state would be somewhere between $800 million and $1.2 billion. By the time it is said and done, and we don't know the final figure, not because of what we're going to spend on the state side, but we don't know what the local entities will spend on enhancements and so forth, we expect the total cost of the armor system be somewhere in the range of $500 to $600 million. Now, that is a significant amount of money by anybody's stretch, but it is much better and much more cost-effective than everybody going out and doing their own thing. And then on top of that, you have the added benefit of a shared system where people have instant interoperability, where if everybody, again, bought their own standalone system, You still have the day-to-day challenges of trying to communicate police to fire across county lines if any type of regional event occurs. I've mentioned this before, and maybe it's worth noting again. The I-35W bridge collapse was a horrible incident where 13 people died and hundreds were injured. But talk to each emergency responder down there, and they will tell you that the armor system and how it performed really aided in their ability to respond to that incident. Matter of fact, Chief Deputy Rob Olson of the Minneapolis Police Department said, "I've always been a cop that has said, we've got plenty of stuff, we need more cops. This incident taught me that we need some stuff, too."
I can hear Rob saying that. Senator Mott?
Well, Madam Chair, Mr. Wiggins, I understand the hypothetical of what could be. The reality is that we're looking at decisions are imminent, and I guess my it's a cold comfort to engage in hypotheticals about what the potential savings could be against the cold reality of in about, 6 months or whenever this legislative session end and the local governments have to make their decisions. When we talk about consolidation of services, we talk about it in the context of how cities and how our state is going to balance our budget and how our local governments are going to balance their budget. And so I just want to, Madam Chair, come back that while I appreciate the potential that this represents, it doesn't translate into hard, cold numbers for me in terms of how we need to budget responsibly, particularly from this committee and as we look at the budget.
Mr. Wiggins.
Madam Chair and members, and I certainly don't envy the task that you have over the coming months. One of the issues, Senator Moi, that is pushing this issue is the FCC-mandated narrow banding deadline. I think many of you are familiar with that. But you have the bulk of radio communications equipment across the state that hasn't hardly been updated or touched in 30 years. And that equipment is not narrowband compliant, and therefore it will need to be replaced. And that's why just about every public safety entity across the state is doing some type of analysis to understand what they need to replace and the potential cost of having to replace that equipment. So on this particular issue of radio communications equipment, the option to do nothing is not an option for many of these emergency response agencies.
Mr. Wiggins, when you're looking at grants to locals to transition to armor, I know my city would like it if there were grants to repay cities that put in significant funds out of their general funds to get this going. And if we could put some money toward repaying some of those, I think my city would be really much happier. So if you can squeeze a few more pennies out of there, if you could add that to the proposal, that'd be grand.
Madam Chair, if I could just comment on that. If you look at the history of state funding, there was assistance given to the metropolitan areas. There has been assistance given to 13 of the 23 Phase 3 counties of this project. And this budget change item would like look at giving some similar type assistance for some of those counties in greater Minnesota that have not had that opportunity. For example, Douglas County is a county that's in the process of transitioning to the armor system. They haven't had those state match dollars available to them.
Members, I think we have one more division of DPS. If we can get that in before we adjourn, I would appreciate it.
Madam Chair, members, the next up is the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, their mission to protect Minnesotans and all who visit our state by providing services to prevent and solve crimes in partnership with law enforcement, public safety, and other criminal justice agencies. They are led by Superintendent Tim O'Malley. Their funding annual appropriation of $43.86 million per year, 41.9 of that from the general fund, and 1.9 out of trunk highway fund. With that, there is a budget change item, and Mr. O'Malley will direct you to that.
Okay. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the opportunity. Tim O'Malley, Superintendent, Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. As Commissioner Leslie stated at the beginning, we all divisions in DPS strive to be mission-driven, and ours, you would note, has we try to provide services. We exist solely to provide services to local law enforcement and others in the criminal justice system in partnership with them. In turning to the first of two budget change items before going through some of the investigative and laboratory and information system functions. The first one is similar to what Director John Willems mentioned. It's not a base budget dollar change. Instead, it's in this case, it is a funding source change. It is about $1.568 million, I believe it is, from the instead of getting it from the general fund, it would obtain that money from the Trunk Highway Fund.
And that's on page 12 of the budget book. And why are we doing this?
This was initially, I think it was 6 years ago or so, that's where the money was from the Trunk Highway Fund. This money is used in our laboratory primarily or exclusively for the DWI enforcement. There have been 27,000 intoxilizer tests done last year and another 7,600 blood and urine tests. And because of its relationship to safety on the highways, this is an initiative to put it back in the Trunk Highway where it was years ago and get a little relief out of the general fund.
Because the Trunk Highway Fund has more money than the rest of us?
I'm not sure about that, Madam Chair. I just know that as we looked at how we could try to make this work, there seems to be a direct link. And not just with pure DWI, when you think of any other crimes on the highways, when there's a criminal vehicular homicide, when the woman in southeast or southwest Minnesota hit the school bus, there's a lot of other analysis that would be done on crimes on the highway that is done by the BCA that could be an offset by using Trunk Highway funds.
This doesn't mean that this would then go to the Transportation Department division, to Senator Murphy's division rather than staying in this division, right?
No, this money would still, it would be used for the exact same purposes at the BCA as it is today.
But and
it would affect, Madam Chair, yes. Would affect Senator Murphy's budget.
By so, about $1.5
million
a year.
So I'm not sure that you can assume that this is a decision this division can make by themselves.
We'll have to work that out somehow. Superintendent O'Malley?
On the next slide, there's the DWI reinstatement fee. And this is this could increase the budget slightly each year for the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. Currently, there is 8% of the DWI reinstatement fee goes towards the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension into a special revenue account. That is then split in an 80-20%, 80% going to the laboratory and 20% to a fund that is used to assist local law enforcement with extraordinary multi-jurisdictional investigations. So this would result in lifting the cap on that, and any funds that do go into there, we would get that full amount. In looking back the last couple of bienniums, it appears that that would probably amount to about $110,000 a year, and our plan would be to use that for scientist salaries.
And members, in your packets, there are copies of the two statutes that are relevant to these two change items. Questions on those two? Continue, please.
Okay, Madam Chair, I'll just very quickly then, if with your permission, move on to some of the services we provide, Investigative Division. And in each of these divisions, the BCA is, as I mentioned, we provide services in partnership with local law enforcement and others in the criminal justice system, in the Laboratory Information Services Division and in the Investigative Division. And there's also training and administrative functions that weave their way through all three of those. But in each of those areas, in the last couple of bienniums, but especially in the last 2 years, we have really focused on trying to be very wise in our use of technology, and also we have reached unprecedented levels of partnerships. In investigations, a couple of quick highlights. I think you're familiar with most of our core functions in death investigation, sexual assaults, narcotics work in the first one there. But a couple of items that relate to some legislative action the last few years and some outcomes. The Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force and the Crimes Against Children division that was created within the BCA a couple of years ago. The legislature appropriated enough money for us to create a division there. Immediately after that was created, the St. Paul Police Department and the statewide ICAC unit, the federally funded unit, moved in with the BCA. That group has combined their forces to handle hundreds of cyber tips. Those are the tips that come in through NCMEC, the National Center on Missing and Exploited Children. There's an 800 number that people can call on any cyber tips for child pornography. And then they also have mandated reporting from some internet providers. So those are filtered through there and come to us. We now, using technology, we have developed, with the funding we got from the legislature, we have developed an ability to forensically analyze computers at a much faster rate than just a couple years ago. So when local law enforcement or some of the ICAC affiliates working with us sees computers, they can get it to the BCA, and we can analyze those very quickly, isolate the images that are pertinent, have local law enforcement look at them, and put together their case. 2 years ago, there were 17 ICAC affiliates, and what I mean by that are local law enforcement agencies that have signed an agreement with the ICAC team. We provide them with some training, a computer, and then they assist in their region. Today, there are 47 such local units now. We've expanded to that point. This group has done a phenomenal job in combating child pornography and other internet crimes involving children, to the point where the Minnesota Crime Prevention Association just last October gave them an award, an annual award, as the team of the year in terms of their efforts. They have also presented, I think it's about 90 presentations in communities and to law enforcement prosecutors to almost 10,000 people in the last year in Minnesota. Another just quick technology item that we provide, you know, our goal in all areas, but certainly in investigations, is to provide services that it doesn't make sense for local law enforcement maybe to invest in as much, to add some value to what they're doing, not to duplicate what they do. We have a number of surveillance techniques, a number of pieces of equipment, some of it purchased with federal money, but we have trained our people in order to go out and use those in those extraordinary cases to help local law enforcement. Another program that the legislature funded was the Missing and Unidentified Dead program, you might remember from a couple years ago. That was one-time money to set up a database to start matching up anybody in NCIC as a missing person. And then we also checked with the medical examiners around the state to determine how many unidentified dead bodies were in Minnesota to see if some of that would match. You may recall that when we started out, there were about 800 missing persons in NCIC. By going through those more closely, we have that down in the 500s, and we now have DNA in the database and dental records, fingerprints, and photographs. On the flip side, they thought there were 19 unidentified dead had been entered into NCIC then. We've gone around the state and identified that there really are about 200 bodies that have now been, we're in the process of entering. And the last thing is predatory offender registration. Started in 1991 with a couple of hundred registrants, and now we're up to 15,000 actual registrants. And as a result of some of the resources and some of the initiatives we tried in the last couple of years, we have our non-compliant rate, which is a very important rate, went down from about 11.5% just 2-3 years ago to 6.3% now. One of the big changes was last year, the legislature passed a law that requires whenever anyone is booked in a jail after August 1st of 2008 that they would automatically be run through the predatory offender database. That has resulted in over 2,700 hits in those months and has brought 340-some non-compliant registrants back into compliance. Moving to the laboratory very quickly. Again, a use of technology and partnerships has helped us make some significant progress there. Some would turnaround time seems to be what the laboratory always is about. But I would also suggest that it's about quality and ultimately justice as a result of maintaining quality as you try to increase capacity. There are a number of interrelated variables that affect turnaround time. Certainly the number of scientists is one. There's also forensic advancements, robotics, the amount of cases we get, certain court rulings. In the past 6 years, we've had a 42% increase in the number of cases that come into the lab. That's a significant increase in terms of capacity of what we need to try and handle. So the demand is up. We have, however, used robotics, especially in the DNA area, and we're moving that into the narcotics area next through some federal grants, and that has helped speed up the time that we can turn some of these cases around. We have some partnerships. One of the big ones is with the FBI. They fund 9 positions in the lab doing mitochondrial DNA work. The advantage for the state is that 25% of those scientists' time can be used exclusively for Minnesota cases. 75% of their time involves federal cases, some of which could be from Minnesota, but they're anywhere around the country. The other partnership we've endeavored in is with the Minneapolis Police Department. They now fund two positions at the BCA. They paid the two DNA positions, and they dedicate the brunt of their time towards Minneapolis cases so that local law enforcement can set certain priorities and address those issues. That has been very successful. In fact, successful enough that I met with Chief Dolan today, and they have in their budget to increase it to four scientists next year. So we're already starting with that memorandum of understanding. Overall, the turnaround time, despite these factors I've laid out to you of some of the challenges in terms of demand, we have overall in the last 3 years taken the turnaround time up from within 30 days. It used to be that 54% of our cases could be done in 30 days. Now of the total cases, 60% are done. So a slight improvement there. And that's all cases. Now, that includes the alcohol cases, which are really very simple ones in terms of the mechanics, the robotics. So if you eliminate those, the numbers aren't as promising, but they are going in the right direction. When you look at DNA, drug, and latent print examinations, which are three of the core ones involving violent crimes, it used to be in 06 that only 20% were done within 30 days. Now we're up to 30% being done in 30 days. The last thing I'll mention is MINJIS, which is the new acronym for the Minnesota Justice Information Services Division at the BCA. This involves CRIMNET and then also all of the core services that we provide in terms of criminal records, fingerprints, integration projects, anything in the criminal justice system. Two real quick items to point out. One is the new AFIS. I know we discussed this some last year, but that has gone from a plan a year ago to it is fully implemented and operational today. In the past year, 2 million fingerprints have been converted from the old AFIS that covers Minnesota, North, and South Dakota into the new one. 6 to 8 years ago, if someone was fingerprinted, it would be rolled in ink, it would be mailed into the BCA, and about 6 weeks later, that law enforcement agency would find out by a biometric measure who was standing next to them. Today, it takes about 3.5 minutes. As they're being fingerprinted, there's no ink, they put their hand on a screen, it gets sent to the BCA, it goes from the BCA to the FBI, and on average, 3.5 minutes later, to a biometric certainty, they know who's standing next to them. That is a huge public safety issue. Instead of having somebody who might have been an escapee from Arkansas for murder, who now 6 weeks down the road, they can say, I don't care what name and date of birth you gave me, I know who you are based on biometrics, you are the person who is wanted in this state, or more importantly with the new, I shouldn't say more importantly, but importantly with the new AFIS, it has the ability to do palm prints, side prints, full finger rolls, and that'll be sent in, and that can then be matched with latent prints pulled from crime scenes. And we have already had cases where someone is booked into a jail, they check it, they send it in 5 minutes later, they'll find out that's the person who left a fingerprint at a sexual assault in Winona 7 years ago. We had no idea who it was. Now we have the fingerprint. So that's the kind of advancement that I think can take some of the most dangerous people off the street immediately. Cybers is one other area that I know we've talked about a number of times over the years. The comprehensive incident-based record system. And that is, a year ago, we had one law enforcement agency contributing to that, Buffalo PD. That was a pilot program, and that went on for a little bit. Today, we have 91 law enforcement agencies. In just 1 year, we've jumped up that much, and that is moving very progressively in the right direction. I have others, but I think I'll stop unless you wanted me to talk about something specifically.
Thank you. Questions?
Madam Chair, Senator Moore. Superintendent, I did have a question about the dedication of the DWI reinstatement fee to creating the account. Do you have information, perhaps not today, but at some point to share with us on, and I've talked to our analysts on that too. I'm interested in seeing what the trend is on that in terms of the monies that are coming in from the reinstatement fee. And do you have any concerns about the dedication and how that fee, I guess how reliable the fee or the amount of money is going to be in the pot?
Superintendent O'Malley?
Madam Chair and Senators, I know that when the fee went up, there was some concern that we may have hit a point where diminishing returns, but I don't think that's happened. And I know that as I said, looking back the last at least 4 years, it appears that the fund would hold at least to the level of where we are appropriated now and probably an additional $100,000 or so. But I'll take a look at that as a trend and get back to you.
Thank you.
Superintendent O'Malley, I know a couple years ago we
We acquired all the scrap yards to be part of the criminal apprehension network, criminal
system,
the CAN thing, whatever that
MCAN, the Minnesota Crime Alert Network.
That,
right.
Yes. How's it working?
I believe it's working very well. I know that when we first did it, people signed up quickly, and we've gotten a number of those alerts out that resulted in apprehensions, and especially with the copper thefts and some of those other things like that. Director of our administrative services who oversees MCAN is here. I don't know if you had anything to add to that, Janelle. Janelle Rasmussen is the director of our administrative and support services.
And she was very helpful to us when we were trying to put this all together a couple of years ago. Thank you.
Welcome. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Janelle Rasmussen. And, yes, we've had a number of successes since we started the scrap metal legislation. And we have signed up, I think, over 150 different scrap metal people onto the Minnesota Crime Alert Network within the first week, and we shared those successes with you. We had a scrap dealer call in and report a success to the network. We have also been working with Wisconsin, Iowa, and the Dakotas on setting up systems similar to this. The Wisconsin Crime Alert Network was introduced last session, and they're working on creating a system specifically for copper theft as well.
Outstanding. Thank you. Do you have any other questions? If members think of areas that were discussed today that you'd like more information and have people come back and give us more information, just let us know in our office and we'll set that up. Anything else, Commissioner Leslie?
No, ma'am.
Thank you all. This is all really useful to us, and I think together we all have a great big job to get done here in the next few months, and we will appreciate your help. Thank you. We're adjourned.
Thank you.